remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for February 1st, 2022 is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01. It's being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, our new Community Legislative Assistant, will now take the role.
Chair Lee.
Lee, present.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Murphy, present.
Representative Erdahl.
Present.
Representative Ekbagi.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Frankie.
Frankie, present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly. Representative Lucero.
Happy Tuesday morning.
Representative Moran. Excused.
I'm present.
Oh, present. Thank you. Present. Representative Pearson.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Ryer.
Present.
Representative West.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
And Representative Lilly. All right, Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. A quorum is present. Chair Murphy, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for April 16th, 2021?
I move approval of the minutes for April 16th, 2021.
Vice Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for April 16th, 2021. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevailed and the minutes for April 16, 2021 are approved. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for December 14th, 2021?
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for December 14th, 2021.
Any discussions?
Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for December 14, 2021 is approved. Members, welcome to the first hearing of the House Capital Investment for the 2022 session. It was very busy interim for all of us as we went on our regional tours for over 14 days, traveling to all corners of the state. And, you know, with the federal government and passing of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, we have a lot of work to do this session. And just recently, the governor and the lieutenant governor released their 2022 bonding recommendations. And today we will get an overview of the governor's 2022 recommendations from MMB Commissioner Jim Showalter. And then we will hear from three state agencies. For the presentation from Commissioner Showalter, we have allotted him 30 minutes and then 15 minutes for the presentation, 15 minutes at the end for questions. And as customary, please use the raise hand function for any questions that you may have. Thank you, Commissioner Showalter. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. I appreciate the invitation to be here and present the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's recommendations today. Also, just so you know, with me is Marianne Conboy, our Capital Budget Coordinator, as well as Assistant Commissioner Jen Hassimer, Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management. I appreciate the chance to present the Local Jobs and Projects Plan in our 2022 capital budget recommendations. Before I get into it though, I just wanna acknowledge the hard work by many Minnesotans that prepared and submitted their projects for consideration. That tireless work of people at MMB and our staff there who reviewed these projects and prepared public-facing documents so that everyone understood what those requests were, as well as the specific governor's recommendations. And third, I just thank the hard work of you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for your review of all these projects, your bonding tours, and I just appreciate all the legwork, literally the legwork that you put in order to get familiar with this process and the projects that we're looking at. We've got a slide deck. Jenny, are you able to bring it up? If you go to the next slide, what you'll see here is the capital budget, what I'm going to try to cover over the next 30 minutes, 25 minutes or so. If you go to the next slide, you'll see just our agenda for the meeting. I'll provide an overview of the capital budget process, so everyone's got a grounding of where these recommendations came from, a quick discussion of the needs for Minnesota's infrastructure, and then I'll provide an overview of the local jobs and projects plan. And I just want to point out, sometimes people ask, well, what about this local jobs and projects plan? And this is really the governor's way of reminding everyone that every one of these recommendations is back door or next door to somebody in Minnesota. Now, that's one of those things about the capital investment projects that, you know, these are all really part of somebody's community. And so we're trying to think about that ultimately so that, you know, we're going across the state, and you'll see that in these recommendations. And finally, we'll walk through the capital budget financing that's included in this plan. If you go to the next slide, great. I'll just talk through the capital budget process. Let's advance one more, Jenny. And you'll see here that, you know, this process actually started even before the last legislative session finished. Back in May of 2021, we asked state agencies, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, as well as political subdivisions to submit their proposals. In a time of telework, MMB continued to put forward, you know, the written instructions that you've come to assume, but also published training videos so that people got a capital budget overview and got familiar with the capital budget system where these requests are entered. In addition, MMB hosted virtual trainings with live Q&As for state agencies and local governments. These were recorded and posted as well. And that's part of, you know, I think the benefit of our growing familiarity with online tools, because it helped get local governments and any submitter in state agencies to get up to speed on their own schedule and always have help at their fingertips. Those recommendations were submitted through the capital budget system and were first published and made available in July. Final requests were submitted and posted on October 15th. From there, MMB did site visits, conducted meetings with agencies, and looked at projects. The governor and lieutenant governor also went on bonding tours across the state, and MMB staff worked with project sponsors to ensure that we had complete information, accurate information, and the projects were qualified for bonding. We posted and we collected also public comments for on local projects. In total, we received 778 public comments, 746, not surprisingly, were in support of specific projects. And in developing those recommendations, then we evaluated all the projects based on factors such as matching funds, if the project was ready to go, sort of shovel ready, how urgent the project was, and alignment with the governor and lieutenant governor's priorities, including creating a more equitable Minnesota. On January 18th, that full recommendation, as you know, was discussed and recommended and posted, and all those final requests and recommendations were posted online. The next slide just highlights the growing need for Minnesota's infrastructure. We could advance one slide, and it's just really the title slide, which is that Minnesota's facing a growing demand for capital projects because they support the services our neighbors expect and deserve. Let's advance that slide and go one more slide, and you'll see that nearly $5.5 billion in requests have been received from state agencies and political subdivisions. $4 billion of this was coming from state agencies. Nearly $1.5 billion was requested from local governments. Capital budget information is collected then at MMB and distributed, and there's open access to all $5.5 billion of requests as directed by statute. The capital budget books are published on MMB's website, and all of that information is available to the committee. The $5.5 billion is a little higher. Go back, Keith, stay on that slide, please. The total requests are about 10% higher than in the 2020 bonding session, reflecting growing interesting needs for different types of assets. Obviously, the list that we have at MMB doesn't include requests that are coming to the legislature outside of MMB's process or legislative projects that the legislature might propose during session. We're not proposing a $5.5 billion bill. So it's just indicative of the challenge ahead for the committee, because there are difficult choices and how to prioritize funding requests. All of these projects have some merit and are interesting and really deserve everyone's consideration. The next slide points out that we recognize that the governor and legislators are also interested in capital needs that are not eligible for general obligation bond proceeds. MMB helped organize the requests from nonprofits that typically seek general fund cash for capital projects. The form template is shared with the governor's office, the House and Senate Capital Investment Committee staff for use when a nonprofit comes up with an idea and wants to be part of the state capital budget. We share completed forms with staff of the governor's office and the House and Senate Capital Investment Committee when we receive them. So far, over $130 million in requests have been received for nonprofit capital projects. And due to the nature of nonprofits work, many of these projects are considered equity and bonding projects, which we'll talk about later in this presentation. The next slide just starts the overview of the governor's recommendations. I'll go through them at a high level. Obviously, we have a couple of commissioners here today to walk through some of those specifics in their package. And I really look forward to getting into each of those specific projects and the discussion there. On the next slide, you see the overview of the governor's local jobs and projects plan. You see that overall, we have a recommendation of $2.7 billion across all funding sources, and they're summarized into five major categories for you to see the top view. That includes asset preservation, community and equity, environmental stewardship, housing and homelessness, and infrastructure. There's 1% we couldn't really fit into any of those, and those include kind of things like bond sale expenses and other financial charges that support the entire package. I'll walk through each of these categories in upcoming slides, but before I do that, I just want to sort of pause for a moment, because there's a lot of different ways of looking at the recommendations. And while this is one way of looking at it, another way is just to understand that climate change and climate projects is a significant theme that runs across all of these recommendations. About $944 million of recommendations really address climate change concerns. More specifically, about $189 million of this plan goes to projects that are designed to prevent and adapt to climate change. By prevention, I'm talking about things like statewide electrical vehicle infrastructure, energy upgrades at the Department of Human Services, and bus rapid transit. Adaption, things like flood hazard mitigation or handling groundwater and avoiding stormwater runoff. Or programs that prevent and adapt to climate change, things like grants to communities to plant trees, easements that capture and hold carbon and slow runoff from heavy rains. An additional $755 million in investments help mitigate the effects of climate change. And these would include dam safety, repair and asset preservation, and other renewal projects that provide energy efficiency. So, you know, when we upgrade a building's HVAC system, roof or windows, there's also greenhouse reductions that result. So there's a number of ways of looking at these recommendations, and I just want to make sure that we think about the cross-cutting nature of some of these recommendations, particularly related to climate change. On the next slide, I want to also highlight another feature that cuts across all of these areas, which is that in many projects, state funds are just one piece of the puzzle for full project funding. Overall, the governor's recommendations are estimated to leverage at least another $2 billion in other funds, such as federal, local, and private funds. So on the topic of leveraged funds, I'll note that the governor's recommendation is specifically designed to provide matching funds for federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funding in two places. At the PFA, for the state's Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Fund program, and for electric vehicle charging infrastructure funding. We're still getting guidance in on the IIJA funds and what is expected for matching funds or how those programs are going to work. As that federal guidance is released and agencies identify how much discretionary grant program can come to the state from those federal investments, we hope to learn more about matching opportunities and we'll share all of that information about these impacts. One other note, IIJA matching funds were included in the governor's supplemental recommendations, and we'll be providing a separate overview on this topic next week to the committee on February 8th. Next slide. So now we're going to get into some of the themes that I mentioned in the overview. Asset preservation is probably the largest theme area and is really a critical issue for this time. Asset preservation is what fixes and improves existing facilities, and 40% of this entire package is dedicated to fixing and improving existing facilities. It's often a priority of governor's recommendations, but I think you'll see in the size and magnitude and importance in this package that the governor and lieutenant governor are really taking this to another level. In the 2020 bonding bill, which was the largest bonding bill passed by the state, only $169 million of GO bonds went to asset preservation. In this recommendation, and this is for the general purpose asset preservation funds, in this recommendation, general purpose funding for asset preservation of $529 million. These investments are really important because we have a backlog, and you've heard that from me, from my predecessors, from MMB over time, but we're not making progress. State agencies currently have $1.8 billion in deferred maintenance. Minnesota State has $1.2 billion in deferred maintenance. And the University of Minnesota has an estimated $2.3 billion in deferred needs. And so it's really important that we put significant money into asset preservation now to prevent things from getting worse. On the next slide, it hopefully will help everyone also think about why the timing is important. It's always sort of easy to put asset preservation off for another year. But on top of the huge deferred maintenance backlog, you need to understand that this recommendation focuses on asset preservation because doing it later costs more. It costs on average an estimated 59% more to repair a structure that's in poor condition than one is than is in fair condition. This is a important strategy for fiscal management and minimizing taxpayer costs to our existing infrastructure. Rating agencies have talked about this and commented on the importance of maintaining the existing infrastructure. And S&P Standard & Poor's recently cited the risks of not doing so, as it reduces asset life, increases future capital costs, and pressures flexibility for future financing. The next slide addresses community inequity, about 14% of our recommendations. And while I mentioned it earlier, every project in this recommendation has positive impact on local communities. This category contains many projects that are specifically requested by local units of government, including $263 million for things like community centers, public spaces, trails, and public safety facilities. Category also includes funding for local government for projects that are for grant programs. $10 million is included for bringing back the Early Childhood Facilities Grant Program, which hasn't been funded since it got about $6 million in 2014. So with this recommendation, entities may apply for funds to construct and renovate early childhood facilities to ensure that families have access to pre-K preschool and other after-school care. The governor and lieutenant governor's recommendation also dedicates a historic amount to equity. In 2020, the governor and legislature invested $30 million for equity and bonding to include community-based organizations that are led by and serve communities of colors and Native American. This was the first time these organizations had access to capital investment from the state in this way. It was a really important first step. With this set of recommendations, the governor and lieutenant governor are recommending over $100 million for equity. This includes $44 million in specific named projects at nonprofit organizations, and $57 million as a set aside for the legislature to evaluate, select projects, and appropriate in this bonding bill. Included in the equity projects that are in the governor and lieutenant governor's recommendations include $2.2 million for critical upgrades to buildings that house youth in crisis, $4 million for a community center to rehabilitate buildings at Camp Parsons in Waterville Township, giving experiences for kids and teens who are historically underrepresented and don't have outdoor experience opportunities, and $4 million for the Keystone Community Services to construct new space for its food shelf program. So there's many important projects that we'll be getting into further, but I wanna hold that forth. The next slide gets into the next segment, which is environmental stewardship, about 10% of the recommendations. A lot of different activity here. We're making investments that conserve energy and invest in affordable new renewables. These reduce energy costs and include things like $10 million for state budget, state building energy conservation, revolving loan program for agencies to finance energy efficiency, $5 million for state building renewable energy production account for solar, wind, and other renewable energy systems to be incorporated into buildings, and many other projects. We're also investing to adapt and prepare for increasingly frequent extreme weather events. You've all seen them, you've all experienced them. Investing in resiliency is another invest now to save later strategy. On average, $1 spent on flood mitigation averts $7 million in future damages. Included in this recommendation are $20 million for DNR's flood hazard mitigation grants to local communities, and $20 million for PCA local government stormwater construction grants to local communities for infrastructure not addressed by the PFA. Investments in this package also will help Minnesotans be better stewards of the land we call home. That includes $10 million for grants to local governments for composting and other programs that add capacity for reuse of organics, and $24 million for the CAP program, a familiar program to this committee. The next slide brings us to housing and homelessness. This is about 16% of the recommendation. Commissioner Howalt talk through these recommendations in more specifics, but I just want to highlight a couple of things, including $250 million for housing infrastructure bonds used as a statewide resource to address the shortage of affordable housing units. This historic recommendation also expands the use of Minnesota housing infrastructure bonds to support the construction of multifamily rental housing. And this recommendation includes $60 million for public housing rehabilitation program. The governor also sets aside funds for local and tribal governments, as well as their nonprofit partners, to build and renovate shelters for individuals and families experiencing homelessness. There's a $70 million investment in the emergency shelter facilities grants here. The next slide brings us to infrastructure. 21% of our total recommendations. These are part of and always part of the capital projects list. They keep Minnesotans and the economy connected, moving across the state. And we do that by maintaining and repairing local roads and bridges, as well as high priority trunk highway projects. We do it by capital assistance in the governor's recommendation, including $210 million for local roads and local bridges. Also recommending $80 million for high priority bridge projects, including construction and engineering costs. In addition, $200 million investment for the Public Facilities Authority Program, which helps communities improve local drinking water, and maintain storm and wastewater infrastructure. And you know, as I know you saw, I saw on the tours how important and how really critical these infrastructure programs are. So I just appreciate your support for this, as well as all of the other recommendations of the governor. The next slide just reminds you of the other 1%, as I mentioned before. This includes bond sale expenses, other financing that isn't included in the five categories. This includes waiving user financing requirement for Ramp F's debt service in order to provide financial relief to the Department of Administration's parking fund. It also includes funding for DEED, Met Council DNR, and public safety to administer local grants included in the capital budget recommendations. That brings us now to the financing part of the story. Next slide, and we'll advance one more. To summarize the governor's recommendation, about $2 billion of this package is in general obligation bonds. About $730 million is in other funding sources. For everyone's just background purposes, the Minnesota Constitution itself defines how a general obligation bond proceed can be used. Must have long, useful life, has to have a state agency or political subdivision owning the project. Key factors must have those. Appropriation bonds are also included in this recommendation, and they're really specifically used for housing infrastructure projects. These have a long useful life, but are not publicly owned. Trunk highway bonds or cash are used to construct, improve, and maintain the trunk highway system. And finally, general fund cash provides the most flexibility and can be used for projects that don't have a long useful life or don't have a useful life of or are not publicly owned. So let's go on to the next slide. This table shows the impact of the governor's recommendation on the general fund and the trunk highway fund. What you see here is that the debt service costs for the bonds in these next couple of years, but just know in the back of your mind that debt service extends well beyond the next biennium. For the general fund cost, you also know that the forecast includes an assumption of how much bonding will be funded based on a 10-year historic average. That shows up as $880 million in bonding bill for the 22 session and $135 million for the next year. These are historical averages and have no relationship necessarily to the debt capacity, which we'll review next. Next slide then brings you to the guidelines. We have these to help us sort of understand the long-term implication of what we're doing today, to preserve long-term flexibility and affordability for the state. The state runs along three guidelines to help guide these capital investment decisions, and the governor and lieutenant governor's recommendation is within all three guidelines. The first two measure existing authorized debt against per state personal income, and the third measures how quickly the state pays down its debt. The first two guidelines would permit about a $3.5 billion package based on the state's strong personal income figures. However, to meet guideline number three, paying down debt quickly and preserving long-term debt capacity, the governor is recommending a smaller GO bonding package of about $2 billion. This recommendation is within all three guidelines and preserves the ability to authorize more debt in the future. Sometimes we get questions about how this Minnesota compares with other states. This slide gives you an idea. This state has moderate debt levels compared with the other 50 states, as reviewed and reported by rating agencies. You'll see here that the state has the lowest, 22nd lowest in terms of debt service to revenues. On the next slide, you'll see a similar comparison, in this case, debt levels compared to personal income. again, Minnesota shows up as a moderate debt level compared to other states. You should know that the passage of the governor and lieutenant governor's proposal today would not materially change how our debt levels compare to other states. And on the next slide, just to remind you that all of this information and more is available at the MMB website under the budget category. You'll see there a summary listing of the state and local projects in the governor's local jobs and projects plan. You'll see detailed budget books, which provide nearly 2,000 pages of detail about the requests and recommendations from state agencies and local governments. And you'll also see an interactive map, which shows requests and the governor's recommendation on the map across the state. It is a big effort to get these recommendations together, to look at all of the projects. And I really appreciate the time and effort that the committee has put into preparing for this conversation and is about to as you debate and put together your own recommendations. I can tell you the governor and lieutenant governor have looked very carefully at this, and I'm really proud to bring these recommendations to you today, Mr. Chair. With that, that closes my presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Showalter, for that presentation. Members, do we have any questions for Commissioner Showalter before we move to the agencies? Representative Erdahl?
Yes, I couldn't find my hand button. I'm out of practice. Just a few things. First of all, thank the commissioner and you, Chair Lee, and everyone for all the work that I know gets put into this, trying to put together a package that eventually we can pass, and we'll hear kinds of numbers, and eventually the hope is that we can make the correct prioritizations and come up with a good bill. Just a couple of questions for the commissioner. You mentioned from the federal government we don't know about all the matching funds yet, and you're working on getting that. Do you have any indication when you will know, Commissioner?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. No. I think we will find out pieces of this information on an ongoing basis, because what's happening is individual federal agencies are providing information on their programs, and they're all going to be working at different paces. We would expect to get some of this information during legislative session, but we don't have a timeline or a commitment as to when we're going to get all this information in. I should also note that I just noticed in the chat, we will, and Kenan will provide the deck that we presented here today to the committee, so staff will have it and be able to follow up.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I would encourage you to try to keep pushing them as well as you can, because obviously we get, as we go through the session, we get into the middle of May or whatever and still don't know some of these things, it becomes problematic. Yeah. One other thing, I've been told of the surplus that we have, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that 2 to 3 billion of that is one-time money. And I'm wondering if the 101 million in cash that you're using comes from that.
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we use a little bit more cash than that. And absolutely, supplemental budget recommendations, we include some cash of the $7.7 billion projected surplus for the bonding bill, both in the terms of the debt service and for one-time cash that's used in it. We have a significant amount of money up front, but as we structured the supplemental recs, and I won't go into those right now, we may take care to make sure that we use those one-time resources for one-time purposes.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. And one other thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is this. We hear every now and then somebody saying that, we don't need to bond. So my question is, Commissioner Showalter, if we didn't do a bonding bill, how would the asset preservation, how would all of the other things that may requests are made for the, well, not the local projects. Well, I it could include that as well, I guess. But how would we pay for things if we didn't do bonded bills?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my guess is we wouldn't. You know, I think the bonding bill is really important. And as I mentioned in the presentation, general obligation bonds are there in the Constitution as a tool to make sure that the state invests in long-lived assets. You know, I think we would habitually underinvest if we had to put cash into our roads, we had to put cash into our buildings. We would only do it when we have surpluses. We would have a constant kind of underinvestment in the state, which over time would lead to lower economic performance, communities that aren't as prosperous, and really be a self-reinforcing cycle. The bonding bill allows us to spread out the cost over a long period of time so that these assets that are providing value not only today, but next day, tomorrow and 10 years from now, are invested and paid over time with the benefit that, so that the benefit and the cost line up. So, you know, this year is a unique year. You're right, we do have a projected surplus, but the bonding program is there to make sure that we consistently invest in Minnesota, we consistently pay for those benefits in a time when those benefits are realized. And that's how we're setting up this recommendation.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Chair Lee. I'll have more questions later, but maybe not.
Sounds good. Commissioner, thank you again. I just have a question. You mentioned in the governor's proposal, there's matching funds for PFA and for EV infrastructure. Are you able to let us know what is the amount for that matching fund? If not, then we can follow up with the agencies when they come by to present on their proposal too.
Certainly, Mr. Chair Lee, I'm going to actually invite Marianne Convoy to respond to that. We restructured the PFA proposal in particular to make sure that we were going to take advantage of that funding recommendation if Marianne can come on.
Okay. Marianne, can you introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Marianne Convoy. I am the Capital Budget Coordinator at MMB. And so for matching funds for PFA, $375 million of federal funds would be unlocked with their state match for the federal grants. And then also for the electric vehicle infrastructure, that would unlock, I'm just pulling that up, $68 million in federal funds is what the estimate is from IIJA for each.
Okay, thank you for that. And just to Representative Erdahl's questions around some of the deadlines, not to you, Commissioner, but just wanted to let members of the committee know that we are, next week, we are bringing in our colleagues from the National Conference of State Legislature to come in and present on the different specific buckets that's been covered in the federal infrastructure bill. And Commissioner Showalter, seeing no other questions, thank you so very much for joining us this morning. And we look forward to the ongoing work with you and the governor's office.
You too. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Commissioner Showalter. Next up, we have the individual state agencies from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Commissioner Leigh Miley Ho. Commissioner, I apologize if I butcher your name. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Commissioner Lee, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Leigh Miley Ho. I am the Commissioner at Minnesota Housing. Leigh Miley is my middle name. That's my Hawaiian grandmother's middle name and her mother's middle name. Don't expect anybody to have to use it, though. So good morning. It is a pleasure to be here. I look forward someday to being with you again in person to talk about the critical needs that we have for housing investments in Minnesota. I would like to just start my remarks by saying that as much as we have all begun to appreciate in Minnesota that housing is infrastructure, if you take a look at the federal infrastructure law that was signed last year, it does not include housing. And so I just want to make that point up front that that we do not have the problem of waiting to find out what the feds are going to give us in housing from the infrastructure bill. We have the problem of knowing that housing is not at all in that package. And so for now, it's on us. Next slide, please. The governor is recommending $310 million in bonding for housing. This would be the high watermark in a governor's recommendation, $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds, which could create as many as 3,500 homes that were either developed or preserved with $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds. We as a state are unique innovators in having created the housing infrastructure bonds. And we have seen the ways in which they can be put to use to build and preserve housing across the state. We also know that there is a huge backlog in public housing rehab, including critical health and safety issues that have sadly come to the fore, as we have seen both locally and nationally, fires in public housing buildings that have resulted in loss of life. And so the governor is once again requesting $60 million in public housing preservation. And this could impact as many as 6,000 homes across the state. Next slide, Dan, please. I should have said I am here with Dan Kitzberger, my legislative director, and Ryan Baumtrog, my assistant commissioner for policy and community development. Gratitude to them for all the work that they've done in helping put this together. You know, the investments in housing, I mean, I have always said, and the governor and lieutenant governor have reiterated, housing is foundational to everything else that we want to do, not only in our lives, but in our communities, in our economic development. Housing is absolutely foundational to everything else that we want to do as a state. Certainly the pandemic and the fact that here we are in 2022, still talking about it, it has kind of elevated, I think, the importance of home for so many people in terms of appreciating how just the ability to stay at home was a part of our public health strategy, and the precariousness of being able to pay for home for so many Minnesotans. Housing stability has been a critical pillar in the governor's One Minnesota plan. And we know that housing instability and the most egregious case of housing instability, homelessness, impacts households of color, Black households, Indigenous households, much more than it does white households. So getting to the core of housing stability for all Minnesotans is also an equity issue. Let me talk a little bit about housing infrastructure bonds. Go ahead and hop forward to Dan. It starts with the premise that actually housing is a private market enterprise generally. And as Commissioner Showalter highlighted, general obligation bonds are really focused on public ownership. So housing infrastructure bonds were created by my predecessors and you all in 2012, and it has become the largest state source of capital for the preservation and creation of housing. And again, the envy of my colleagues around the country, it is a unique Minnesota innovation. These housing infrastructure bonds also leverage an extraordinary amount of local, federal, and private investment. When you take a look at the amount of money we put into a project with these bonds compared to the total development cost of a project, it's basically almost a one-for-one leverage, although it varies by year depending on how much a new construction versus preservation that we do. Next slide, please. The housing infrastructure bonds help us build and rehab permanent supportive housing for people or families experiencing or at risk of homelessness, and also for people with behavioral health needs. They allow us to preserve federally assisted rental housing, which is so important to keeping those federal rent subsidies in our communities. It helps us create more housing that's affordable for seniors. I always smile, age 55 and older, having crossed that threshold now, but for seniors in communities around the state, statutory preference for people with extremely low incomes at 30% of the median income or lower. New in 2018 also, it's allowed us to finance manufactured home community acquisition and improvements in infrastructure. I mean, these are like really critical safe water infrastructure and storm shelter infrastructure and just roads that allow school buses to go through a community or garbage trucks to go through a community. Absolutely critical infrastructure needs for manufactured home community residents. And then expanded use in 2020 for the creation of single family homes, which has included the acquisition or development of homes on community land trusts. If you take a look going back, next slide please, Dan, to 2012, just over $500 million has been authorized, and it has leveraged a total of $960 million in development costs. So you can see that one-to-one leverage since the housing infrastructure bonds were created. We've done more than 6,200 units of new development or preservation, including units that are in the pipeline right now. It's been an absolutely critical resource for us to reach lowest income households in Minnesota, again, including permanent supportive housing and the new construction of senior housing. I just last Friday, we announced the 2021 selections. Next slide, please. We were able to do 1,545 units of housing with the housing infrastructure bonds that we had available in this year's funding round. It included $5.3 million for 16 proposals and 88 single family homes, including 36 homes that are a part of community land trusts. We have seven proposals that we selected for manufactured home communities, $5.4 million, which supports 789 families. And then on multifamily rental housing, we have four supportive housing projects, $37.4 million for 225 units. That is both construction and preservation. Senior housing, $55.6 million for six proposals. That's 364 units of senior housing. And preservation, one project, $1.5 million to preserve 80 units of housing. Packaging all that together through our annual consolidated RFP is just in a good news, bad news week last week. It was great to be able to get the selections out for this year. I'm going to take a moment and do a touch base on our public housing general obligation bonds. So public housing, what's kind of traditionally understood as HUD public housing through public housing and housing redevelopment agencies across the state, serve about 36,000 low-income households. There are a lot of kids in those homes, but also a lot of our elders and individuals with disabilities. Notably, 65% of these households have incomes of $15,000 or less, living on a very small fixed income. The vast majority of public housing units in the state are aging, more than 20 years old, many of them actually built in the 70s. And so, you know, these general obligation bonds allow us to really prioritize projects that deal with basic life and safety issues in buildings, replacement of elevators, replacement of old boilers, sprinkler systems, and other key things for just the bare minimum upkeep of the project. I will say that, you know, this is an area where the federal government that helped construct these units has not been able to keep up, has not been willing to keep up with the just maintenance of these buildings over time. And so our investment in preserving these critical public housing units impact towns all across the state. When I've been able to travel, it's quite striking. When you're in a small or medium-sized town, any place in Minnesota, oftentimes it's the public housing building is the tallest building in town, even if it's just the four-story senior high-rise in a community. Just have a slide that summarizes previous authorizations here, going back again to 2012. They have been small bonding authorizations relative to what we're asking for here. It's allowed us to do a small number of projects to kind of chip away at the deferred maintenance needs. But I think the governor and lieutenant governor and I appreciate the fact that the need is far greater than what we have been able to do. So $60 million would basically double what we've been able to do since 2012. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions that you have, Chairman Lee, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Hall members, do we have any questions for Commissioner? Representative Bajie.
Thank you so much, Commissioner, for being here with us today. I really appreciate this presentation. Kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about the public housing needs that we have across the state. Our understanding, I think, from a couple of visits that we've had through our investment tours and through conversations I think we've had with the housing committee is that public housing requires much more than the $60 million that's being proposed. So can you give us some insight into that and kind of, what are some thoughts about the capacity that you guys have to be able to work with these public housing units to be able to address a greater need than what is currently in the proposal?
Commissioner Hall.
Shirley, Representative Abaje, I am Shannon Guernsey from Minnesota NARO is an excellent representative of this group and could talk extensively about the needs of our public housing infrastructure. And what I know is that because the amounts that the agency has had available have been low, that oftentimes it's been spread across some smaller preservation projects, and yet you have some of the larger public housing authorities in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some of the larger greater Minnesota cities that have large-scale projects where the communities would really benefit not only from the health and safety improvements, but also the quality of life improvements. Like, for example, we saw at the Elliott Twin Towers in Minneapolis that the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority recently did. So I think that what the public housing preservation geo bonds have allowed our agency to do is to kind of chip away at minimum health and safety needs. I think that ideally we would partner this with an infusion of federal funds to be able to really go after the large scale preservation projects that would allow an expansion of the number of units, increased quality of life, in addition to dealing with the health and safety, the bare minimum health and safety needs of these communities. My guess is that we probably could do $500 million of public housing improvements across all these units in the state. $60 million would be a signaling in that direction, but obviously we need the federal government to step in and take some of the responsibility for this as well.
Representative Bajie, any follow-up?
Just quickly, thank you for that. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that, Commissioner Ho. I agree with you. The federal government does need to step up, and I hope that us here in the committee can hopefully expand a little bit on the proposed budget to be able to continue to meet some of those needs and send a stronger signal. So, thank you so much, Chair.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And my question is for the commissioner. So in the presentation that was just given, housing infrastructure bonds were implemented in 2012. They were expanded, I believe, from the slides, they were expanded to the 55 plus community in 2018, manufactured homes in 2018, single family homes in 2020. Where do you see this expanding next?
Commissioner Hall.
Chair Lee and Representative Raleigh, thank you for the question, because this has certainly been a conversation inside of the housing community. One of the things that we're proposing with this is the opportunity to do units for households that are 50% of area median income and lower, that don't require supportive housing, that aren't senior specific communities. We have heard this from the development community, that the opportunity just to continue to use these housing infrastructure bonds to focus on working families that are lower income, that don't need supportive services, is a critical area. And so that is a part of the governor's proposal in this legislative session.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the commissioner again, right now you, I think as a couple slides ahead of the one where we're on right now, you said that there's projected 8,724 units of public housing mixed between the various approaches, the 55 plus manufactured single family. In your estimation, how many are actually needed? So if we've got 8,724 projected now, what is your overall projection for the next 2, 4, 10 years? I mean, how far out do your projections go as to what the actual need is?
Commissioner Hall.
Chairman Lee and Representative Raleigh, first let me just say that the portfolio of investments that Minnesota Housing makes in housing is a mix of private market and public housing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the partners that we work with are private developers, both for-profit and nonprofit, mirroring the fact that the housing market nationally is predominantly a private market driven affair. It's a public-private partnership when we make investments in housing. When the housing crash happened in 2007, 2008, 2009, development kind of ground to a halt. And but growth of families in the state did not. And so what ended up happening is that the market fell out of balance, and we had more households in Minnesota than we had housing units. And that's something that I think has been deeply appreciated for the last 4 or 5 years. But we just need to have a year over year investment in being able to catch up. The supply demand gap is further exacerbated for very low income households, because there's a mismatch between the cost of the units that are available, the price of units that are created in the private market, versus what many Minnesota families can afford. And so the essential role that our agency plays is by using these state investments and bonding to create incentives for the private market to create and preserve units that are targeted to households that make the least. And that can be a newly formed family, that can be an aging senior, that can be a person who's experienced homelessness, that can be somebody who's in an entry-level job, and that could be just, you know, there's a lot of Minnesotans that are in these lower income categories, and that's the unique role that we play at Minnesota Housing.
Representative Raleigh, last follow-up, and then...
Yes, thank you very much. And Commissioner, you just mentioned something that I'm very interested in, and that is you're looking for incentives between the public and the private sector. How does rent control factor into the commissioner's view on what's happening with the expansion and the pushing for the private and public sector to be able to provide more housing to these 8,724 plus units?
Commissioner Hall.
Chairman and Representative, when the federal government or Minnesota Housing invests in a project, depending on which financing tool we use, there is a contractual understanding with the developer around the setting of rents. And a lot of that is tied around the kind of general rule of thumb that people should pay no more than 30% of their income on rents. It's tied to the area median income and kind of what a rent level is for somebody at 30, 50, 60, or even 80% of area median income, depending on which type of program that we're using. And you know, a lot of what we try to do with federally assisted housing in our preservation efforts is make sure that those project-based Section 8 vouchers, which allow people to pay no more than 30% of their income on rent, are preserved in the community as opposed to having those buildings be converted to just market rate housing. So most of the federal and state funding tools are invested in projects with an understanding that there will be some basis for where rents are pegged and the income of the residents who live there.
Thank you, Commissioner Ho. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ho. And first of all, Commissioner Ho, thank you for coming into my district last fall or summer, whenever it was, to look at a couple of projects that we have in Eden Valley and Watkins. Those are important to this area. But workforce housing, of course, is a big concern in greater Minnesota, particularly where I live here. And in talking to developers, we found that they feel tied by regulations that driving up the cost and looking to do some regulatory reform if we can. But that's a question for another time. Commissioner Ho, with our housing funding, is there a breakdown? Generally, how much of this money goes into greater Minnesota and how much into the metro area?
Commissioner Ho.
Chairman Lee and Representative Erdahl, it feels almost like an unknown period of time ago that we were standing in a field and then walking through an about to open new workforce rental housing in those communities. I enjoyed that visit a lot. I miss being on the road and invite invitations to come and meet you in your districts and talk about the housing needs. We'll get back out there maybe on Fridays during this legislative session.
Make sure you see the twine ball in Darwin when you come by.
A lot of good history for the community that I learned from you there, sir. If you take a look at the governor's total budget and bonding recommendations, there's over $1 billion for housing and homelessness, including this $310 million in housing infrastructure bonds and public housing. We also are recommending increases to exactly those workforce housing projects like the type that we visited in your district. And I think that what, you know, I deeply appreciate is that the housing needs are great and diverse, and that it is important for us to be able to attend to the unique housing needs that different communities prioritize. And that's everything from shelter in the DHS budget, permanent supportive housing in ours, through rental housing for all ages and at various income levels, as well as continuing to foster single family home ownership. So the total package, when you take a look at the governor's bonding and budget package, really does reflect the need across the housing continuum. And I think that one of the things that is that is really, I think, well designed about Minnesota Housing's consolidated RFP is that we open up to communities to say, tell us what you need, tell us what you want to do. And then behind the scenes, we're able to do kind of a mix and match of a whole bunch of state and federal resources to try to match the right funding stream or bonding source to the project relative to the available uses. So I've said this before, but I interact with my colleagues in 49 other states and territories in the district. And I mean, one of the things that makes Minnesota Housing special nationally is the partnership that we have with you. And having tools like public housing preservation geo bonds, having tools like housing infrastructure bonds, and having the appropriated line items, it allows me to dig deeper. It allows me to do more for hardworking, low-income Minnesotans across the state. It allows me to do more for people experiencing homelessness than many of my colleagues are able to do. And so I deeply appreciate this partnership and the opportunity to talk about the resources that you make available to us.
Representative Erdahl, last follow-up, and then Representative Ryer.
It's Chairman Lee, I didn't mean to dodge Representative Erdahl's specific question. If you take a look over time, it's about a 50-50 split. That's not true on each line item each year, but we really try to pay attention to making sure that the state resources are distributed in greater Minnesota as well as the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Lee. And just to reiterate to Commissioner Hull, thank you. The geographic balance is very important in housing as it is in other areas. So thank you.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Commissioner Ho. It's good to see you. I've appreciated your emphasis on go big when it comes to housing, and you'll recall that I was saying go bigger. So I think we're on the same page with that. I want to talk about an issue that's been concerning me, though, and ask your input. In both affordability and single family home ownership, we are seeing challenges based on the gobbling up of single family homes and our NOAA stock by out of state investors and depleting the housing stock. I don't know what levers you have at your disposal, but when you mentioned the community land trusts and programs like that, I'm wondering how you see that issue and where you are going with that and where you'd like to go but need resources for. Thank you.
Commissioner Hull.
Chair Lee and Representative Ryer, thank you for that question, and thank you for our continued dialogue around housing issues between sessions as well. If you take a look not at the governor's bonding proposal, but at the housing side of the governor's budget proposal, this year we have a new line item called community stabilization, for which the governor proposes $100 million of appropriated funds. This would allow us to be responsive both in the single family and the multifamily rental market to preserving homes, especially homes that might otherwise be sold and have their prices either be moved out of single family home ownership on the single family side and moved, there's been a fair amount of press to out-of-state corporate investors who convert it to a rental market and who are not always the most attentive landlords, I think. There is a story in the press just last week about families up in Columbia Heights that are being impacted by this, but also allow us to do preservation of affordable rental housing that doesn't have a federal or state subsidy in it today. It's an area where you need nimble capital to be able to have a nonprofit move in on a sale when a current owner wants to sell, but then you also need oftentimes rehab money in order to bring what might have been lower rent and aging units up to modern standards. And so that is an area that the agency that I am very interested in playing a greater role in. And so we're very excited to have $100 million for community stabilization in the governor's proposal. That can complement the use of federal tax credits and other dollars in terms of what's needed to be able to rehab units.
Representative Ryer, last follow-up. We had to move on to the other agencies.
Thank you. One brief follow-up, Commissioner Ho, if you had a wish list, is there another pool that bonding could support that would be available. And that might be something we just dialogue about offline. Thank you.
Commissioner Ho.
Chairman Lee and Representative Ryer, $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds. Housing infrastructure bonds have been an amazing tool, and we haven't exhausted what they're able to do. Even as I made selection announcements last week, I do it with a heavy heart, knowing that I say no to 3 out of every 4 proposals that come through my doorway, many of which are ready to go and much needed in their community. So by expanding both on the public housing side and with housing infrastructure bonds, it will allow us to do a lot more. Say no less, say yes more. And so we can talk about other vehicles, but I think these are two critical ones. And I don't think that we have remotely tapped what they're capable of doing. Chairman Lee, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about these critical housing investments and for your consideration over the course of the session. I look forward to being available to talk more about them as you see fit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Ho, so very much for coming by this morning. Next up, we have Commissioner Roberts Davis from the Department of Administration. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and members. For the record, I'm Alice Roberts Davis, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Administration. Just making sure you can hear me okay.
We can hear you. Proceed.
Great. Thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. Wanted to share with you some of the proposals for the Department of Administration. I'd like to start with an overview of our capital budget requests and the rationale for what's included. Our proposals will assist in the state's service to citizens, as well as our ability to recruit and retain the state's future hybrid workforce on the Capitol complex. We're concerned with remedying the persistent shortage of funds in the Capitol complex parking account. Our proposal will help to prevent prohibitively high parking rates for contract parkers and the public. It will also ensure the parking account has enough funds to maintain all facilities. This capital budget presents an opportunity to help harness the energy to fight climate change while making our operations more efficient. The governor has included strategies to reduce energy and water use in our state government operations through an investment in our State Building Renewable Energy Generation Fund and State Building Energy Conservation Revolving Loan Fund. We also recognize the need to maintain adequate funds in the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account, or CAPRA. This account is available across state agencies to address emergency facility failures and to abate unexpected hazardous materials when they're discovered. Finally, we're focused on investing in the future of the Capitol complex. These aren't new proposals, but are dollars for removing failing facilities and improving the accessibility of leased buildings. So as we get into the details, first, the governor recommends permanently relieving the state parking fund of the statutory requirement to pay the debt service for Ramp F. This will remedy the ongoing emergency low balance in the parking account. Costs in the parking fund are recovered by settling and charging parking fees for contract parkers and the public who park on the Capitol complex. The revenue shortfall in the parking account was exacerbated by significant parking cancellations and decreased use of the state meters throughout the pandemic. Next, the governor recommends $7.5 million in general obligation bonds to maintain CAPRA, the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. CAPRA funds emergency repairs and hazardous materials abatement for state agencies. This program ensures state facilities which experience unanticipated emergencies are operational again quickly and that construction projects are not unduly delayed if hazardous materials are discovered. Next, we have three proposals to provide resources to state agencies to make their operations more efficient. First, the governor recommends $10 million from the general fund to add to the revolving loan fund to finance energy efficiency and water conservation improvements in state facilities throughout Minnesota. These improvements lead to more efficient state buildings and reduced energy costs. The fund was established in 2021 with dollars from the renewable development account. However, these funds are directed to give preference for use on buildings located in the Xcel Energy Service territory. Admin is requesting additional general fund dollars to ensure that funds are available for state buildings throughout the state. The governor also recommends $5 million from the general fund for renewable energy investments at state-owned facilities. Possible projects at state-owned facilities include solar, wind, biomass energy systems, and geothermal heating. The governor also recommends $5 million from the general fund to build out the state's electric vehicle charging infrastructure. These dollars would fund the installation of fast DC charging stations and level 2 dual port charging stations across the state. These stations will accommodate the charging needs of electric state fleet vehicles across the state, and some locations would be accessible for use by the public. Finally, we have a few proposals to invest in the future of state and leased buildings. First, the governor recommends $3.626 million from general obligation bonds to complete the demolition of the Ford building and prepare the site for development. This includes removing all hazardous materials and stabilizing the site with landscaping features until authorization and funding for a replacement building are obtained. The building has been vacant since 2004 due to deterioration and the need for major repairs. It's located on prime real estate across from the light rail station and connected to the Capitol Tunnel system. The fiscally responsible thing to do is to demolish the building because its annual upkeep has already accrued over $1 million in taxpayer debt, and the envelope of the building needs to be stabilized, which is expected to cost an additional $300,000. Next, the governor recommends $33.4 million from general obligation bonds, and $13 million from the general fund to implement the remaining security upgrades recommended by the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security. These upgrades were identified in the 2013 physical security study and the recent security assessment upgrade update, which is nearing completion. This video shows the new turnstiles and security kiosk in the administration building, which were made possible by a portion of the $10 million appropriation in 2018. While this funding has been much appreciated across the Capitol complex, considerable vulnerabilities remain, and a general fund appropriation will be needed to secure buildings that are not eligible for bond-funded upgrades. Finally, the governor recommends $1 million from the general fund to establish a centralized funding source to correct physical barriers in state-owned and state-leased buildings in order to improve the public's physical access to state services and employment opportunities. These funds would be available for use by state agencies, boards and commissions, the legislative and judicial branches of government, and constitutional offices. By improving the physical access to state government facilities, this program will also improve the independence and productivity of Minnesotans with disabilities. In summary, here is an overview of our requests. I hope that after this presentation, you have found each project to be well-reasoned and addressing a key need. I appreciate the opportunity to present admin's capital budget requests, and this concludes my presentation. I stand ready to answer any questions that you may have.
Members, any question for Commissioner Roberts Davis? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner Roberts Davis, for coming by and joining us this morning. Next up is the final state agency, Department of Corrections, with Commissioner Schnell. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Paul Schnell, a commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. With me today is Dave Wisniewski, who is our Capital Resources Administrator. I want to thank you for the chance to speak on the department's request today. We have a number of really important projects that serve the mission of the DOC and the public safety needs of Minnesota. I'd also like to thank the committee personally for visiting the Faribault facility in early November. I was participating in parole hearings that day, and I was unable to join you, and I wish I could have been there. In understanding our bonding request, we think it's important that you understand the mission of the DOC as a state agency. We are really focused on changing how we approach the work to develop and grow better, safer outcomes for Minnesota communities. We also look at the ways, what works in corrections and what will make our state safer at the end of the day. In pursuing our mission, we are shifting to a more person-centered approach. We're working to ensure that each person that we serve entering incarceration has a holistic, thorough assessment done, and that his or her needs are then put into a plan in order for them to receive what they need throughout their term of incarceration and ultimately re-enter the community, which 95% of those incarcerated in our state prisons will one day do. This is what the DOC seeks to build, a place where change is possible, and we can help people become good neighbors, live better lives when they are released, and ultimately improve the safety of Minnesota. But we can't do that when our roofs are leaking, our pipes are crumbling, and we have space for only a fraction of the transformational services that are required in order to achieve our mission. A brief overview of the facilities across our state. As you can see, we have four facilities that are over 100 years old, and people live in and work in these buildings 24/7, 365, every day of the year, around the clock. And the DOC has a significant footprint, as you see, across the state. The age and size and uses of these buildings are important to understand. The crumbling pipes and walls, broken windows, leaking roofs impact the daily work of staff, the conditions in which incarcerated folks live, and when we expect them to come out better, it's really important that where they come from provides the kind of environment to achieve the goals that serves Minnesota's interests. Overall, the DOC's request is $87.6 million. Asset preservation is and continues to be a top priority for our agency. It has to be with so many buildings in the condition that they are. $58.1 million is needed critically and badly. The next three requests that we'll cover are really related to expansion of programming space and facilities. In order to achieve our transformational goals, we have to have spaces and places for rehabilitation and services to be provided. These services are critical if we want the better outcome. Research tells us what works in corrections and what will ultimately reduce recidivism and create better safety and better outcomes for the people that we serve. And ultimately, it's these services that we seek to address with these requests. So $664 million total in deferred maintenance was part of our 2021 facility condition audit. $150 million plus of that, the total needed overall for high priority projects across the state. So we have tried to identify those facilities that have the greatest need. The DOC conducted this facility condition assessment, which we've outlined, that we have a significant number of buildings in serious, somewhat disrepair. Specifically, 19 of those buildings are in crisis condition, 63 in poor condition. People work, as I mentioned earlier, in these buildings 24 hours a day, year round. They work overtime and they take many personal risks in service to the people we serve and to the people of Minnesota. They miss holidays and other important events in the lives of their families as they work in these environments to make Minnesota a better place to live for all of us. The people we serve live in these buildings 24 hours a day. They sleep there, they go to school there, they work there, they attend religious services there. They share their fears and confront the demons that ultimately cause them to enter these prisons. Hopefully, and with the services that we provide, we will help them to become better neighbors, employers, students, and parents as they reenter communities across our state. We as Minnesotans expect all this to happen inside these buildings, and yet many of us would, in some instances, not want to work in them or expect our loved ones to be in them to build the lives that we would hope that they have. To achieve the outcomes and safer communities that Minnesota expects, from the time a person serves their prison time, we must invest in the resources to allow that to happen, to serve the safety needs of our state. I'm going to then just talk a little some of the projects more specifically. The next project is the restoration and expansion of the Dakota building at the facility in Faribault, which you all saw last November. Faribault is the largest facility in the DOC family of facilities. And as you saw last fall, the Dakota Camp building is a minimum security unit outside the secure perimeter fence. The men who live in that building and receive programming there are nearing the end of their term of incarceration. The services and supervision they receive at the Dakota building are critical to get right, and particularly as they begin to reenter communities and make and reintegrate into our society and the community-based workplaces. With the new space planned in this project, it will support these men and their access to programming, such as adult-based education. We want to make sure people are going out with that minimum of that high school diploma or GED, treatment services, pre-release classes, those transition classes that are so important, as well as programming around housing, employment, budgeting, living on supervision, and maintaining and creating a healthful living environment. Individual services are also available in each of these buildings as these men approach their release. As you saw on the site, the bonds will fund a renovation of the building and needed expansion of that space, in addition to critical brick and mortar repair. As you can see in the photo, this is what happens when I think that outside building envelope, as Commissioner Robert Staples just mentioned, deteriorates and ultimately the masonry fails and it begins to fall off the building. The next project I'd like to provide a little bit of a brief overview is for programming space at the state's only women's facility at Shakopee. This is the only facility in our state that serves women who are incarcerated. However, the availability of space has not increased as that population has grown over time. When this prison was built, it accommodated 350 women. Today, the population of women at the facility ranges more in the 500 to 600 range. We have community partners and staff who have transformative programming offerings such as parenting skills and creating strong family reintegration connections, education, treatment, and more. But this facility does not have the space to provide those services to the extent that they're required. Finally, the DOC looks to is seeking funding to request in the investment of rehabilitate the currently vacant building at the Lionel Lakes facility. It's referred to as the E building. This particular facility is in Representative Raleigh's district. The building is in a central location at the facility and would provide necessary and needed treatment space, something that is in high need for the people we serve. I would point out that the Lionel Lakes facility is the DOC's central. While we provide treatment at facilities all across the state, a Lionel Lakes facility is our central treatment facility for substance use disorder, as well as a sexual offender treatment services. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for the time. I'm always happy to show or provide you with opportunities to access these facilities and visit with them and or discuss individual questions. We are here to answer any questions you have. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would open it for any questions committee members would have. Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners. Now, seeing no questions from members, I want to say thank you so very much for hopping on to join us this morning. And then members, before we end and adjourn for today, I just want to say thank you all for joining the committee on our tours, the committee members and staff who were there for the whole 14 days. Just so that you all know, we traveled through, on our 5-day tours, over 369 miles and heard from 273 sites, 143 presentation, and then 130 visits. Especially many thanks to the communities that we were able to visit throughout the entire time over from September when we first started to mid-November when we ended in the suburban communities. With that, members, our next meeting will be on Thursday, February 3rd, and we will continue to hear from the other state agencies from the governor's 2022 bonding recommendations. The committee is adjourned.